It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, fake news, the completely made-up stuff, swept the internet last year, and it's become a big part of our elections, the response to mass shootings, and more. We'll talk about the impact of fake news and what doesn't work to stop it. First, Wisconsin's foster care system could see a number of changes under a package of 13 bills in the state assembly. The bills are written by members of the assembly speaker's bipartisan task force on foster care. According to numbers from the Children's Hospital of Wisconsin, more than 6,000 kids are in the state's foster care system, and the background and the needs of those kids have changed over the last few decades. Representative Steve Doyle is a Democrat representing Wisconsin's 94th Assembly District, which includes Onalaska. He's one of the co-sponsors of the package of bills, and he's a co-chair of the task force. Representative Doyle, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what kind of conclusions did the task force come to when it came to foster care in Wisconsin and what's needed?
Well, probably the most important conclusion that we came to is that there's no silver bullet. We have a lot of issues that need to be dealt with, but the important thing is that we came up with ideas that aren't Democratic ideas or Republican ideas. They're bipartisan ideas that we think are going to pass fairly quickly and without really much controversy.
At a really basic level, I mean, is the problem that there aren't enough people going into foster parenting in the state?
Well, that's one of the problems. But, you know, we're looking at it a little more globally than that. We're looking at actually, you know, four or five different areas. One is prevention. You know, if we can keep kids from going into the system, that will help a lot right there. We're looking at, number two, the kids in the system. Number three, we're looking at the foster parents. Number four, we're looking at the counties, you know, basically the funders of this. And then we're also looking at the kids that are aging out of the system and how we can, you know, get them basically integrated into society, get them into college, for example. And then finally, we're looking at the process of termination of parental rights. So a lot of different areas that all came under our umbrella, but we have suggestions on each of them.
Let's get into some of those areas now, and let's start with what you mentioned, prevention, keeping kids out of the foster care system in the first place. With the new legislation, what kind of help is there to do that?
Well, what we're doing is what I guess you might call some incentive grants, and so these would be some matching funds. If a county comes up with 10%, we'll take care of the rest of it. What we're looking for are, oh, maybe you could call them outside-of-the-box ideas. If a county has an idea of what might help to keep kids out of the system in their county, let's try it. Let's throw a couple dollars at it. And if it works in County A, we'll try it around the rest of the state. You know, I'm from La Crosse County, which has really a good history of innovation and trying new ideas. We pilot a lot of programs for the state. And people have found some of the things that we've done can be replicated around the state. And so it's really that kind of idea. Let's let the counties be the ones that are, as they say, the hotbeds of innovation. And if they come up with something that'll work elsewhere, you know, then we can take it statewide.
Then what kinds of things are you doing to help kids who are already in the foster care system or who go into the foster care system?
Well, there's a lot of different concerns there. One of the most important things to recognize is that the kids that we have in the system today are not like the kids who were in the system 10, 20, 30 years ago. When we had our public hearing in La Crosse, for example, one of the judges noted that, you know, it used to be when you get a call at the county for a social worker to go out to an abuse or neglect case, you know, it was what they referred to as filth and squalor. You know, the parents were poor housekeepers. There was maybe rotting food on the counter or not much in the refrigerator and so forth. And so you take the kids out for a few days, the parents get their act together, and the kids go back. Now, most of the counties that testified across the state said that anywhere between 80 to 90% of the kids that they have in foster care come from drug-related situations. So the needs of those kids are dramatically different. You know, they have behavioral issues. Sometimes they actually have addiction issues. They have attachment issues, all sorts of different things that really put them in a category where we're talking a lot higher level of support that they need to keep them safe, keep them healthy. And so we're looking at, you know, mental health things. We're looking at even something as simple as getting them integrated into a school. You know, so one of the programs we have is to make dollars available. If kids need or foster parents need money for some, activity fees for the kid to get involved in, say, a sport or show choir or something, so that they don't feel different than everybody else. So some of this isn't rocket science. It's just like, we know what we need, we just don't necessarily have the resources.
We're talking to Representative Steve Doyle from the Onalaska area, looking at a package of legislation, looking at the foster care system here in Wisconsin. And Representative Doyle, from what you were just saying about the needs of at least some of the kids in the system who might need mental health care, addiction treatment even, that's going to be an additional challenge to the parents. So what kind of help are you looking to give foster parents with those kind of situations?
A couple of things I'd really emphasize. Number one is education and training. If a foster parent has a child come into their home that has taken from a home where not only did the parent have an addiction issue, but because of the fact that you can absorb drugs from your parent's system into yours just by physical contact, some of these kids have their own addiction issues. And obviously newborns that have an addicted mother may have that similar thing. So, those are things that we need to give our foster parents some training so that they understand how you deal with a drug addiction issue, or perhaps an ODD child, oppositional defiant child, just because it's not, again, as I said earlier, the kind of child that we saw in previous years. So education, training, those kinds of things. Another thing that is really important is the respite. If that foster parent or that foster family needs a weekend or two off every once in a while just to kind of relax a little bit and get away from the constant needs of a foster child, we want to make that type of service available to them. So again, it's something that is pretty straightforward, education, training, some time off. We're not necessarily talking about a lot of money. One of the things that we did not have foster parents come to us saying is, increase our pay. They all tell us we're not in it for the money. We prefer not to go broke, but we have different needs rather than just giving us a pay raise.
Now, how about outreach? I imagine there are a lot of people out there who either have never even considered being foster parents or who maybe thought about it but found it overwhelming and didn't pursue it any further. How do you reach out to people to say, hey, maybe this is something you could do?
See, that's what we're trying to accomplish by this. We don't want it to be a frightening situation where, oh my God, I'm going to get a bunch of drug addicted kids. My life will never be the same. It's not that. The foster parents that we met at hearing after hearing after hearing were committed people. They were normal people. These are not, in many respects, they certainly are superhuman. I mean, they're doing wonderful work. But they are like you and me. I mean, anybody out there that may have some interest in this should explore it a little bit further, because we can give you those resources. We can give you some training. We can give you some support. La Crosse County has a program that we're hoping, along with other counties, will go even more statewide, which is the court-appointed special advocate program, where there's a person who comes into the home to kind of see what's going on and offer some help and offer some feedback to the judge in terms of needs or wants that may be existing in that particular household. So we think it's something where there may be a fear factor that keeps a few people away. Don't let that stop you. At least explore it. At least talk to other foster parents. Talk to county social workers. You may find that you are just the perfect person.
And Representative Doyle, as we wrap up, we've touched on some of the legislation. There's a lot here. What is the timeline that you see this starting to move through the legislature?
Well, this is the Speaker's task force, so he's told us what our marching orders are. And at the rollout earlier this week, he indicated that he wants the public hearing on these bills to happen during the month of December, and he would like to get them passed through the State Assembly by the end of January. I expect that that's the timeline we're on in our House. And once it gets over to the Senate, we have been looking for some senators who are willing to really take ownership of this issue. And there's some good ones over there. There's some senators that actually have a background in adoption and foster care. And so we think that we're going to have some folks over in that House that will feel just as motivated to do something about the situation as we're finding in our House.
Representative Doyle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I sure appreciate it.
Representative Steve Doyle is a Democrat who represents Wisconsin's 94th Assembly District, which includes Onalaska. He joined us to talk about a package of bills he's co-sponsoring that would support the state's foster care system. Fake news was a huge presence in last year's election season and since then, too. From made-up news about candidates to fabricated stories in the aftermath of mass shootings, fake news stories have been widely circulated, especially on social media. But what kind of impact do they have, and is it possible to stop them or at least slow down the flow of misinformation? Emily Thorson is an assistant professor of political science at Syracuse University and co-editor of the forthcoming book, Misinformation and Mass Audiences. Emily, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Let's talk about a definition of fake news. We throw the term a lot around for different things. Originally, I thought it meant stuff that people just made up and then circulated online and elsewhere.
That's actually a pretty good definition, and I think it's the one that academics tend to use. So when we talk about fake news, we're usually talking about pieces of content that are deliberately intended to deceive and that are kind of masquerading as real news. So they have headlines on them to make them look like they are true.
And this isn't just political. There's a lot of political fake news, but it gets into a lot of spheres of our lives, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And, you know, I am a political scientist, so I tend to study a lot of political fake news. But honestly, especially after editing this book and looking at a lot of different examples of fake news, I think that fake news around health is actually some of the most concerning because it has some of the most direct effects on how we actually behave. So whether that's fake news about vaccinations or something else, that can have direct effects on kind of the choices that we make about our own health, the health of our children.
If I sit back and think about it, I would think in the information ecosystem, if there was a true story and a completely made-up story, there'd be like an evolutionary advantage to the real thing, and the made-up stuff would have a harder time spreading. Obviously, I'm wrong. Why does fake news spread so well?
I don't think you're necessarily wrong, right? I mean, the vast majority of the news that people consume is real news. Right, the fake news still makes up a tiny, tiny minority of the news that people is actually exposed to. But insofar as fake news does spread, it often spreads because it kind of pushes a lot of our buttons, right? The folks who design fake news know exactly, they're designing it often just to get us to click on it because they're trying to make money oftentimes. And the things that get us to click on things and share things are things that arouse our emotions and information that's novel. And fake news has both of those things. It's often, especially in the political world, something that makes us really angry and or excited. And it's often something that we haven't heard before because it's made up, obviously. And so those two things both kind of encourage us to both to click on it and share it in a way that sort of real news might not.
And staying in politics here, is it possible to measure the impact that the flow of fake news stories has on political participation, how we vote, that kind of thing?
Well, I think you're asking the right questions. You know, a lot of times when people ask me about did fake news matter, what they mean is did it shape the election, right? And that is certainly an important outcome. Evidence for that is pretty, I would say suggests that it did not have a huge impact on the election itself, mostly because the types of people who are exposed to, you know, let's say a fake news piece saying that Donald Trump was endorsed by the Pope are the people who are already really likely to support Donald Trump. So it likely did not have a big persuasive effect. But I think fake news can have some other effects, right? I mean, you kind of talked about a demobilizing effect. So does fake news potentially being exposed to this sort of thing make people less likely to participate in general? How does it affect trust in media is a really important question. If you continually see things that are later debunked, then maybe you're going to trust all media a little bit less, and that could be potentially really worrisome. We don't necessarily have the answers to that yet. I think researchers are working on that now, but even though misinformation has been a part of the political ecosystem for a long time, this specific format of fake news is relatively new, and so we're still kind of trying to figure out what those effects might be.
Now, we have a lot of fact-checking operations out there. I kind of started, actually, to check statements usually by politicians, but it's definitely branched out into fake news, and you have websites like Snopes trying to debunk online rumors and fake news. Is that a good way to tackle the spread of misinformation?
It can be. I think especially when you have these fact-checking organizations working in tandem either with mainstream media outlets or with platforms like Facebook. And that's what we're seeing more of. Facebook has introduced this disputed tag to articles that have been fact-checked by organizations like PolitiFact or Snopes, so that people have a better sense of when they encounter a headline in the context of social media, whether it has been disputed. The problem is just relying on fact-checking organizations is that people just don't go to those websites very often, right? They don't get a huge amount of traffic. So what works best is when they really work with other news organizations to kind of get those out there. And it's also important to keep in mind that fact-checking organizations serve another purpose, which is to, disincentivize politicians especially from lying. So there's been some really great experimental work looking at what happens when politicians know that fact-checking organizations are watching them, and what happens is that they actually tell fewer lies. So that's a really encouraging finding. Whether that will discourage the purveyors of fake news is another story.
We're talking to Emily Thorson from Syracuse University, co-editor of the upcoming book, Misinformation and Mass Audiences, looking at fake news and how to try to stop it if it can be stopped. And I first came across your work, Emily, in an article about fake news that came out in the aftermath of a mass shooting. And something that seems to happen, I think you talked about this in the story and others did too, is that right after a mass shooting, we know very little. We know very little for a long time. And so there's this gap. People want to know more stuff, and this is a great entry point for fake stories to catch on.
Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And, even in politics, I think you see some of this just because there's a constant news gap or news hole in politics, right? It's hard for any news organization to keep up with the enormous demand of the public for more and more and more information. And so I think that's something to be really wary of as journalists, is to not just report on the most recent rumor or the most recent thing that you've heard, but instead to take a step back and think about and verify.
You mentioned earlier the creators of fake news having a profit motive. If I can create content that people link to, I can make money. Is that one possible entry point to try to stop the spread of fake news, changing the incentive?
Yeah, it would be tough to do, and I am not an expert in kind of Facebook algorithms, and I think that really is up to Facebook. And we get so much of our news via Facebook right now, and that's how a lot of this fake news is spreading. Their system is still really closed. They haven't worked with researchers much to try to address these questions. They're trying some things on their own, but it's not really clear without empirical testing which ones are going to make a difference.
We in the media look at social media a lot, try to keep up with the latest developments in news stories. Do you think that makes us overestimate the effect of fake news and things that spread on social media when maybe the public isn't as attached to it as we are?
Yes. I actually talk about this a lot with my students in my political science class. I tell them over and over again, you're different. You're different and you're weird, right? Most people, it's not that they're paying attention to fake news. It's that they're not paying attention to any news. The amount of news that someone gets in their Facebook feed, this is hard news, I think it's about maybe, 8% of the content in their news feed is actually hard news. So very little of what they're seeing in their Facebook feed is news at all. And then a much smaller percentage of that is fake news. And I understand why we get so worked up about fake news. It can seem frustrating and scary, but the reality is, you're exactly right, that most people just aren't paying that much attention to this.
Now, for people who are consumers of news, maybe via social media, do you have any thoughts or advice on how to up our detectors of fake news to try to spot or at least check out something before we believe it, maybe even spread it ourselves?
Well, the two guidelines that I would give to people who are sort of more media savvy are, first, to don't be afraid to shame other people for spreading fake news. So if you see somebody spreading an unverified rumor on Twitter or on Facebook, call them out on it. I think this kind of enforcement of social norms is going to do a lot of good in stopping the spread of fake news. The second thing I would say is to be wary of spreading something just in order to correct it. So if you see that, Donald Trump says something that is wildly false and you want to retweet that and say, can you believe that he said this false thing? Maybe hold back on that, because the problem is that it's hard to sort of unring that bell of misinformation, that when people are exposed to the misinformation, even in the context of it being corrected, it can still have kind of lingering effects on attitude. So better to just not spread it at all, even if your motives are pure.
Getting back to that shame concept, Emily, this is maybe more of an etiquette question, maybe outside of your main research area. But, you know, I've had relatives on both sides of the political spectrum spread fake news and thought about correcting them. And, you know, how do you approach that with somebody you want to sit down for, you know, Thanksgiving dinner with next year?
My approach is to congratulate them on what they are doing that's good, which is engaging in the political process, right? So, you know, telling them that you are impressed by the fact that they are caring enough to read political news, to share political news, that puts them in a minority of Americans already, and that is empirically a good thing. But then follow that with kind of the chaser of, but this isn't actually true. It might help to share a time that you've been fooled by fake news so they don't feel like you're calling them stupid, right? So say, this can happen to anybody. You know, I shared this thing that turned out to be false the other day. Sort of do whatever you can to take the blame off of them and not make them feel stupid for falling victim to this.
And briefly, as we wrap up, Emily, is this a hard topic to research given how quickly social media technology, for example, changes? The thing you're studying today may not even be the platform people use in 2 years?
Yes and no. I mean, if you think about testing specific interventions, I think that can be tough, but the basics of how humans process information aren't really changing. And we have in communications and political science some really great theories and evidence about how people process information, and those fundamental rules aren't really changing much. So we can use these theories that we've developed over the past 20 years or so to, I think, understand how people are processing information in a new media environment as well.
Emily, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Emily Thorson, Assistant Professor of Political Science at Syracuse University, co-editor of the forthcoming book, Misinformation and Mass Audiences. For millions of people around the world, coffee is a part of the daily routine, whether it's relaxing at a cafe or fueling up before work or during work. Coffee has spread from Africa to all parts of the globe and become one of the most valuable commodities in the world. A new book details the history of coffee and threats to its future, from disease to climate change. Jeff Kohler is an award-winning writer, photographer, and cook based in Barcelona. His latest book is Where the Wild Coffee Grows, the untold story of coffee from the cloud forests of Ethiopia to your cup. Jeff, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, take us to that birthplace of coffee, a region in Ethiopia.
Yeah, the Arabic, the origins are in these cloud forests about 300 miles or so southwest of Addis. It's an area of kind of deep valleys and dense forest and very small hamlets. And within parts of those forests, you have wild Arabica still growing. They still go into the forest. They still forage for it and collect it every year.
And it's called the strain of coffee we drink, Arabica, which misleadingly makes us think it came from the Arabian Peninsula, right?
Exactly. That narrative that Arabica is from Arabia is wrong. It was misnamed a couple of hundred years ago. People still believe today that it is from there. Arabia was actually the first place to cultivate it on a commercial basis, but it's not where it originated.
And what do we know about why people in Kaffa in Ethiopia first started drinking and, I guess, eating coffee?
Right. Well, it started as a food, it looks like, in that people really take advantage of absolutely everything in the forest. And when you see these beautiful, bright red berries, of course, it's natural you're going to taste one. A coffee fruit that's ripe is it's kind of fruity and has kind of a watermelonish, kind of mango-y taste, but there's very little meat. But they also take the leaf, and they still today make a coffee leaf infusion. So coffee, as we know it, actually from the coffee tree began very differently than today. But eventually they discovered the beans that when they're roasted in the ground and brewed into a coffee. But I make the argument in the book that coffee drinking developed indeed around those forests. I mean, it was just a logical progression of it going from a leaf drink or to a fruit to indeed to the beverages we kind of know it today.
And people kind of make fun of fancy coffee shop culture now, putting so much work into a cup of coffee and a lot of labor and fussiness. But For the people drinking coffee in this original area, it has a big cultural, symbolic significance, and they have a coffee ceremony. Can you tell us about
that? Indeed. Preparing coffee is so elaborate that they actually call it a coffee ceremony. You know, you go to your local coffee shop, and you think that the barista is doing this enormous job preparing your cappuccino. But when you go to somebody's place in Kaffa or in all over Ethiopia, and they have the green coffee beans that they first wash, and then they roast them in front of you, and then they grind them in front of you, and then they brew, you know, in this big kind of terracotta pot. It can take an hour at least, or 2 hours. And you, of course, get snacks, but one is surprised in the beginning that it's not a cookie you get. It's something salty. Popcorn is the most typical snack to go with coffee, or like a popped barley. So this is a bit surprising. And the coffee itself, some people drink it with salt. Sometimes they put butter into it. You don't have 1,000 choices. There's no decaf. And, you know, in somebody's home, there's no, you know, 10, you know, 4 kinds of milks you can add. It's everybody drinking the same coffee. And certainly one difference that I saw compared to, you know, in the U.S. is that coffee is a social beverage. You never drink it alone. And every meeting has coffee. It's, you don't, you know, get your coffee and walk around. It's very much the social beverage.
We're talking to Jeff Kohler about the history and future of coffee. His new book is called Where the Wild Coffee Grows. And Jeff, take us from this very, very local drink to a worldwide phenomenon. How did that happen?
Well, it spread, as I said, it was first cultivated in Yemen, in Arabia, and Mocha, their main port, had a monopoly on coffee for about 2 centuries, from the mid-16th century or so, as coffee drinking developed in Europe and the Middle East. But it was too popular, of course, not to spread. And eventually it did. And it around 1720 to 1750, really when it began to spread. And within just a couple of short decades, it was growing on 5 continents. Arabica grows quite easily in the right conditions, and it spreads quite rapidly, and it's kind of similar. And, you know, today it grows in 40 countries, more or less between the Tropic of Cancer and the Tropic of Capricorn.
There's a lot of talk about how coffee is grown now, and there's fair trade coffee, and people talk about shade-grown coffee. And the shade, it turns out, was an important part of the early development of coffee. Can you talk about the role of shade in coffee plants?
In Kaffa and in the forest, the wild Arabica certainly grows under heavy shade. It's one of the many trees, but it grows under a deep canopy. And in fact, wild coffee fruits look the same as a normal cultivated coffee fruit, but the tree is very different. The tree, a wild coffee tree, is very skinny, and it grows up towards that light. It tries to get through that canopy, and it's only producing enough coffee to really perpetuate the species. Cultivated coffee tends to be in Latin America, a lot of sun, and if you have that, a lot of chemicals go into it. But really, the natural way to grow coffee is in that deep shade.
And you mentioned Central and South America, and a lot of the coffees we can buy at the store are, of course, from that part of the world. How did that happen? How did that become such a huge coffee-growing region?
Well, it spread, as I said, from Yemen, and eventually went. The Dutch and the French were the first ones to kind of spread it, but eventually all of the main European powers kind of grew it on their own colonies, and it really took well to Central and Latin America. And today, you know, Latin America produces about 85% of the Arabica. Brazil is the biggest producer in the world by far. There were about 12.5 billion pounds of Arabica produced last year. That's something like 6 times the weight of the Golden Gate Bridge. It's a lot of coffee. And is 85% of that is from Latin America.
And I understand, and this is something that could keep coffee drinkers awake at night more than the caffeine does maybe, there are concerns about the future of the coffee, especially in Central and South America. A couple different ones. One of them, climate change. Can you talk about why that has coffee lovers worried?
Well, indeed, the Arabica is a really sensitive plant, and they think that a 2 or a 2.5 degrees Celsius increase in temperature would basically kind of trim by half the suitable growing land of Arabica in the world. You get 3 degrees and you really you have to move your coffee significantly higher, which is difficult to do because most of the world's coffee growers are smallholders on small plots of land, and you just can't simply move your coffee up. It's, you know, one scientist said, kind of simplistically put it, he said 1 degree, you know, affects taste, 2 degree affects productivity, and 3 degree is dead. And that's kind of a simple way to look at it. I mean, it's really a sensitive plant. And the other big issue is a fungus called coffee leaf rust. And the climate change is kind of aggravating that. It's a disease that is kind of comes in waves, and it's mutating, and it's becoming more severe. And that the changes in climate and the wetness and the heat are making it more and more difficult for farmers every year.
You also write about maybe a more fundamental problem, a lack of genetic diversity in the coffee strains that we rely on to drink. Can you talk about that?
Exactly. Well, there's two reasons. One is the history. It's that coffee, how it spread from Yemen, it really is based on two plants, one we call Tipica and one we call Bourbon. So a huge percentage of the Arabica is really based on those two, because the plant itself is self, what they call selfing. It doesn't need another plant to reproduce. And so you have these big fields that are nearly clonal because the plant is reproducing itself. And what that means is that it can't adapt to these changes in the climate. It can't adapt to kind of new diseases. Genetic diversity is fundamental for the survival of any species, and Arabica is certainly no different.
We're talking to Jeff Kohler right now. He's the author of Where the Wild Coffee Grows, The Untold Story of Coffee from the Cloud Forests of Ethiopia to Your Cup. You can join in with your thoughts and your questions at 800-642-1234. Do you have kind of a coffee ceremony? Is there a ritual around the coffee drinking in your life, or is it just sort of a grab-and-go scenario for you? Have you been to a part of the world where the coffee culture is different than where you live now? And are you worried about human or environmental impacts of how coffee is grown and threats to the future of coffee? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Right now, we're continuing our conversation about the history and future of coffee with Jeff Kohler. His new book is called Where the Wild Coffee Grows. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the history of coffee and how it became a staple in so many different cultures? Have you traveled to a part of the world that treats coffee differently than you're used to? What blends and brews do you go for? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go right to our callers. Renee is with us in Phelps. Renee, hi.
Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Great.
What did you want to bring up, Renee?
Well, I just wanted to confirm what your guest speaker was saying about the coffee ceremonies in Ethiopia. My husband and I went to Ethiopia in 2010 to adopt our daughter. And we had a few coffee ceremonies with the adoption agency staff at the agency in Addis Ababa. And then again, when we drove, we'll say about 4 hours into the far off regions where the children actually came from, and we got to meet the surviving family members that we were adopting from, you know, their children from. But anyway, we did enjoy that coffee ceremony, and it was quite lovely, and I want to say almost sacred, because they would place a white, almost like a braided carpet, small carpet on the floor, and they either sat on the floor, the staff members, or they might sit on a little stool, and they brewed the coffee beans right there in front of you over the coals.
Renee, I want to jump in and bring Jeff back in on this. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and congratulations on the adoption, too. Jeff, almost it feels sacred, Renee says, this coffee ceremony.
Yeah. Indeed, they're burning incense at the same time. And there's always some grasses and some flowers spread around under the place where they're making the coffee. That's a symbol of the forest, because they believe that, it's nodding to the spirits of the forest that are part of this process. And it's definitely taken seriously. The people take time. Every step is very well known, and it's anticipated. And they come around, and you smell the coffee roasting when it's done, and you ooh and ah. But it's kind of like a Greek play. You know what's coming, and the appreciation is in the execution of each step.
Wow. Renee, thanks for sharing that story at 800-642-1234. We'll go next to Eileen in Madison. Eileen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Eileen?
I just wanted to share my coffee experience. I'm an avid coffee drinker, and my husband has started roasting beans on his own to kind of control the freshness of the coffee beans. So I think that's something that ordinary folks can do, and it really makes a difference. You don't know what is on the shelf and how fresh it is. We learned this going to El Salvador, visiting a friend down there who was helping to export more coffee through his USAID group, and cupped some coffee down there, and it really makes a difference when it's fresh. So I think I'm concerned about global warming and the impact on the coffee growers, because we saw it's very labor intensive and pretty high up in El Salvador, but there wasn't a lot more places they could go higher there. So.
Eileen, thanks a lot for that call. We touched on the global warming climate change issue, but also Eileen says, Jeff, very labor intensive. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it's all hand collected, or especially when you start, it kind of goes together, because when you have a good shade canopy, you know, then you start hand collecting it, it's more laborious and you're producing less. And this is one of the issues that when you're producing kind of shade heavy coffee, your production is going to drop down. And so the farmer has to be able to find a way to make up that income. And ideally they can get a higher amount of money for their coffee. This is the goal, to produce it in a more natural, environmentally friendly way. This help kind of fight against climate change by having this canopy of shade trees, but you know, ideally to find a way for them to be able to be compensated for that.
Eileen, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Jeff Kohler is with us. We're talking about the history and future of coffee. His new book is called Where the Wild Coffee Grows. Jeff, we've been talking about environmental threats to coffee. Talk about the environmental impact of growing coffee, especially without that shade canopy.
Well, this it's called the full sun coffee is that it's big fields where you don't have any shade trees. You need to give a lot of chemicals and so on to these trees. The trees tend to have a much shorter lifespan. Some of the trees, I think, in these full sun areas lasting 10, 15, 20 years, maybe much less. It's a much deeper impact on the soil, because it's really taking a lot out of it. But the shade certainly is a more natural way of growing coffee. You just look at how it grows wild in heavy shade. And the tree itself naturally, I think, wants that shade. And, of course, any environmental setup with this, you know, a bigger kind of community of different types of trees, you tend to have a lot more birds than more insects. You just kind of create this kind of microsystem or microcosm is a much more natural way of producing the coffee.
And Jeff, as you were saying earlier, the lack of genetic diversity, especially for the Arabica strain of coffee, that's a problem. It makes other risks way worse. You write that actually going back to the starting point of coffee, again, back to Ethiopia, the solution may be there in different strains of coffee.
Certainly the largest amount of genetic diversity is at its source. This is where diversity is its greatest. And so one of the things is to try to tap back into some of that diversity. It's not so easy. It's very difficult to tell on a tree in the forest, in the wild forest, how, you know, that is going to be produced in, say, El Salvador in full sun. It takes a couple of generations. A generation for coffee is 4 to 5 years, so it's a long process. It needs to be systematic, and they're just kind of The coffee community is realizing the problems now, and now they're going back into the forest to try to do that. But some have said, you know, I feel like we're a decade late, you know, because it's such a slow process. Science is helping, but at the end of the day, they really need to see it a couple of generations to see how well it adapts to its new environment.
We've mostly been talking about the Arabica strain of coffee. There's also something else out there, Robustus, is that right? And is that a coffee we like to drink?
It is. It's the second largest cultivated species of coffee, and it's the one that is it has a lot higher caffeine level, so it's the one for instant coffee specifically, a lot of caffeinated drinks, and there's a lot of coffee blends that are using some of the Robusta, giving a little bit more of a jolt. This past year, it was about 40% of the coffee production was Robusta. It's growing every year because it's a much more resistant type of coffee. The flavor itself is much lower. It's much less refined than Arabica, but the tree itself is resistant to coffee leaf rust fungus, and it grows, it's a much hardier tree, much cheaper to produce. So you're seeing a lot more blending. If you're looking for, you know, Arabica, you got to make sure that package of coffee says 100% Arabica on it.
On a personal note, Jeff, you've been writing about coffee, journeying around the world to check it out. Has this all changed the way you think about coffee and drink your coffee?
Indeed. It's completely altered how I drink the coffee. I tend to buy my beans freshly roasted every week. I go down to my local roaster. But I drink almost exclusively Ethiopian coffee now. for me, it's the flavor profile that I really like, but also having spent so much time in Ethiopia and seeing those areas, you know, up close for, you know, many weeks, really getting to know some of the producers, it completely is, I think, has also added that element to my coffee drinking. But the Ethiopian coffee is certainly some of the most interesting flavors. It's really fruity and flavorful, and it's what I today really enjoy drinking.
And do you think we could gain something by re-embracing that social element of coffee, not just drinking it on the way to work or whatever, but making it a social ritual?
Absolutely. I mean, it started out that way. I mean, coffee houses began as social institutions. I mean, the coffee itself was almost secondary, or it certainly wasn't the only reason to be there. And if you look at the original and the old histories of coffee houses, they were loud, noisy places. Today, of course, you make too much noise in your local Starbucks and everybody starts glaring at you. But it wasn't always how it was. And it would be nice in some ways if it kind of came back, that social element, almost like a kind of a bar scene where it was, you know, around the coffee.
And I don't know if you do the full Ethiopian coffee ceremony yourself, but do you feel more ceremonial when you are preparing your coffee?
Yeah, I'm a bit more ritualistic. I like to prepare mine in a Chemex, a particular way of doing a kind of a hand pour over filter coffee. And so there is certainly a bit of ritual to it, beginning by folding the paper filter and weighing out the ground. So yes, in my own way, I have my own private ritual, you know, three or four times a day.
Well, Jeff, thank you so much for spending this time with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, it was a pleasure to talk today.
We've been talking to Jeff Kohler about the past and future of coffee. He's a writer, photographer, and cook. He's based in Barcelona. We've been talking about his new book. It's called Where the Wild Coffee Grows: The Untold Story of Coffee from the Cloud Forests of Ethiopia to Your Cup. If you have a story about coffee in your life, is it a part of your social routine? Are you particular about which kind of coffee you drink? Are you going to try to make it a little more of a ritual, a ceremony yourself? Let us know. You can share your story over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. Are you addicted to your phone, or is someone close to you addicted to their phone? An inventor thinks he can help out with a substitute phone. It's just a phone-shaped, non-digital rectangle with some stone beads that you can swipe left or swipe right. Producer Amanda Magnus uses her phone from time to time. Hey, Amanda.
Hey, Rob.
So you're a heavy user of your cell phone.
Some people in my life might say addicted. I think it's a little harsh, but it's true.
And do you think you need a solution? Is this a problem you want to fix?
I'm fine with it. I think some people in my life might think it needs to be fixed, but I'm cool.
Okay, so now we've got this substitute phone, assuming you wanted to cut back, which you don't. But so it's beads, and you can like swipe on it. It's something to fiddle around with to take the place of your phone. Do you buy it?
I do not buy it. I think the reason I'm addicted to my phone is it's more of a mental thing. It's not a tactile thing. I have lots of bent up little paper clips at my desk that provide that kind of distraction for me. I don't need a new expensive stone bead thing to replace that.
It's wanting to see the information, the text, the story, whatever.
Oh, yeah. It's wanting to know what my friend said about my witty text.
All right. We'll look for your next witty text. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You used to call me on my cell phone.